Dr. Robert Mayer has been a central figure in the evolution of clinical research in the CALGB, and I met with him for an update of the group's current plans. Dr. Mayer began by putting in perspective the recent explosion of available clinical research information in the field.
There's been enormous progress in the treatment of colon cancer, with six new drugs having come onto the market within the last several years. As someone with enough gray hair to have experienced 20 years of famine, we have a short burst of fertility here, and hopefully that's really going to continue. The CLGB is endorsing the ongoing adjuvant trial of the North Central Cancer Treatment Group to determine whether cetuximab adds to the benefit of FOLFOX in patients with stage 3 disease. The CLGB, along with SWOG, is conducting an intergroup trial chaired by Alan Vinook and Chuck Blanke, which is examining the value of adding either cetuximab, bevacizumab, or a combination of cetuximab and bevacizumab to either FOLFOX or FOLFIRI as initial therapy for patients with colon cancer, metastatic colon cancer. Where are we going to go in the future, and what sort of questions can one address? I think one can approach this from two or three different angles. One angle is continued investigation of new drugs. Certainly that's happening, but I wouldn't say that the list of new drugs at the moment is quite as promising as it was in the past. Recent past, a second approach would be to try to identify biological markers that would predict for responsiveness for a given patient. For example, we have utilized a large adjuvant trial, 9803. It was a stage 3 adjuvant study that was chaired by Leonard Saltz, which failed to show, surprisingly, that the addition of irinotecan to 5-FU and leucovorin was useful in people with stage 3 colon cancer. That's the bad news. The good news is that there were a large number of patients in this study who all completed questionnaires, in whom we have lots and lots of prospective data and data that is continuing now at this point. For example, we have learned that the 16 or 17% or so of these individuals who had microsatellite instability, a defect in DNA repair in their tumors, appeared to actually benefit from the irinotecan, whereas the majority of patients who did not have this microsatellite instability failed to benefit.
Has that been presented?
It has been presented at the AACR. It has not been widely distributed because it's very new.
Very interesting.
And it is something that is provocative, but it's a retrospective subset and it needs to be confirmed, but this would be extremely useful. I mean, one of the questions that Neil Maripol labored over in a very thoughtful editorial in the Journal of Clinical Oncology a few months ago was, why was Saltz's adjuvant trial negative?
Yeah.
Here were multiple, three randomized trials in advanced disease where adding irinotecan was useful, and now we have three adjuvant studies that consistently and reproducibly fail to show that. Well, is there a subset of patients who do benefit? Is there something about metastatic disease biology? At any rate, this is one area that we are pursuing. Monica Bertinoli, who is an experimental surgeon in the CLGB in particular, is very interested in exploring this to a greater degree.
Can I just ask you, biologically, what does microsatellite instability look at, and any hypothesis about why that might cause? I mean, we know from stage 2 there's the question of prognosis, but why it would have something to do with irinotecan?
Well, it's a good question. Microsatellite instability is a marker for a hereditary predisposition to colon cancer known as hereditary non-polyposis colon cancer, first described by Henry Lynch and sometimes known as Lynch syndrome. About 5% of colon cancer patients have Lynch syndrome. However, about 15 or 16% of colon cancer patients have microsatellite instability in their tumors. So not all microsatellite unstable tumors are part of this genetic grouping. We do know that prognostically, as has been published in the New England Journal of Medicine, that if there is microsatellite instability, the prognosis is better than if your microsatellite's stable. But yet, as the ECOG group published several years ago, Stan Hamilton and his colleagues, being microsatellite unstable also indicated less benefit from 5-FU-based adjuvant therapy. It's the difference between a prognostic marker, natural history, or a predictive marker, meaning responsiveness to a given form of treatment. So 5-FU wasn't high on that list, and it was already speculated at that time that something that would also deal with DNA repair, like irinotecan, might be useful in a tumor that can't repair DNA, which is the microsatellite unstable tumor, and irinotecan might be a better drug.
So again, just, you know, like, what is the microsatellite and why would that sort of...
Well, microsatellite instability basically refers to excess numbers of nucleotide molecules. It's as if you made a mistake when you were typing on your computer and your spell check would correct it. Here, as DNA is synthesized, there are mistakes that are made, and normally they are corrected. In this circumstance, they're not. So they're like loops of extra non-functional DNA, and that's what's known. These are known as microsatellites.
So when it's microsatellite stable, does that mean that that's there or unstable?
No, microsatellite stable means that it's been corrected.
So it can do DNA repair.
That's correct. So there's a defect in the DNA in the tumor, and irinotecan works by inhibiting topoisomerase 1, which is a DNA repair enzyme. So one could speculate that the two of these have something in common, and therefore the microsatellite unstable tumors might indeed be a bit more responsive to irinotecan.
How impressive were the differences that we're seeing or the impact that we're seeing in these patients?
It's about 20%. Yes, it's impressive, but it's not statistically valid because sure, it is a subset approach to doing it. But it's very interesting. And I think it also reinforces what is special and valid about the continuation of cooperative group studies. Because here was a study that was done to test whether adding X to Y would be useful, and it wasn't. And yet, here's a whole lot of information that came because these people were examined.
Not to mention that all the work that Jeff Meyerhart and your group did.
That's just what I was going to say next.
I interviewed Jeff for the series.
Yes, that's exactly what I was going to say next. The other thing that happened was that Jeff Meyerhart and Charlie Fuchs, based on their experience with the Nurses' Health Study in Boston, developed a prospective questionnaire. And now we're learning about diet effect, exercise effect, lifestyle effects, and we have blood samples. So we'll be able to look prospectively at different cytokines and insulin growth factor receptors and the like and see if they correlate.
When are we going to see that?
The publications about the exercise and the diet have begun to appear, and there are more that are coming.
What about the insulin growth factor and all that stuff?
That's in the works. That's in the works.
That's going to be fascinating.
It's also very interesting as people think about what can I do about my health after I've had colon cancer. On the one hand, you say I've got to exercise and I'm just going to eat radishes and lettuce and carrots. That isn't what Meyerhart found. He did not find that diet restriction protected. He found that diet excess, what he called a Western diet, lots of fat, obesity, made worse. So it's almost like as you become obese, as you develop type 2 diabetes, you're also stimulating a variety of hormones, cytokines, things that may activate microscopic tumor cells. So you're asking, what is CLGB going to do next? We have a proposal that has been submitted by Jeff to the GI Intergroup, which will be hopefully the next adjuvant stage 3 trial. And it is a 2-by-2 randomization. Randomization 1 has to do with exercise. yay or nay, prospective exercise. And number two has to do with another observation, which has to do with vitamin D. There are emerging data that low levels of vitamin D, inadequate amounts of vitamin D, is associated with a higher risk of cancer. If you go to Scandinavian epidemiologic data, you find that there's more cancer that appears in the winter when there is less exposure to light than there is in the summer. And the nurses' health study and the professional health study all suggest this as well. So one arm of this would be a prescribed exercise trial or no exercise trial, and the other randomization would be vitamin D supplement or placebo. Now, this is a very unusual intergroup colon study. This is not pharmaceutical company's new drug or targeted molecule, but this is really to quantitate in a prospective manner these fascinating interventions, which are a heck of a lot cheaper and less toxic than giving cytotoxic drugs.
I mean, not to mention that just sort of looking at this grossly, and you know, granted, you can talk about maybe the flaws of this, but I mean, you saw like a 50% reduction in relapse rate. This is not a small difference.
No, this is not a small difference at all. On the other hand, if you're a skeptic, you will say that the person who exercises is a healthier person to begin with, and the person who doesn't may have other comorbid problems. They could have cardiac troubles, pulmonary. But we're also now looking, one of our trainees with Jeff is looking at smoking. What happens after you've had stage 3 colon cancer and you continue to smoke, or you don't smoke, or you change your smoking patterns? Does that alter outcome? There has been repeated, even meta-analysis data, that shows that colon cancer is a smoking-related tumor. It has remained uncertain what it is about smoking that does that. It's hard to imagine that the nicotine or tar directly is going to affect the colon. Is it affecting something in the bile? Is the bile leading to a carcinogen in the gut? Is it causing some other cytokine? I don't think we know that at this point.
You mentioned the adjuvant trial looking at cetuximab, as well as the trial in metastatic disease looking at cetuximab, Bev, or the combination. Mm-hmm. What's your thoughts about some of the data that's been coming out looking at KRAS and EGFR inhibitors?
Oh, it's fascinating. This week's Journal of Clinical Oncology just has a paper, a very clearly stated paper with cetuximab. And at this meeting, at the ASCO GI meeting, the panitumumab data from Europe is going to be presented, broken down by KRAS. I think this really gives us a terrific opportunity to understand what KRAS does and what it doesn't do. It also explains to an enormous degree why the large SWOG pancreatic trial that was gemcitabine, cetuximab versus gemcitabine showed no benefit, because essentially 98-99% of pancreatic cancers have KRAS mutations.
Interesting. How about colon?
Colon, it's about 40%, and stomach and esophagus, it's only 8-10%.
And the mutations are the patients who don't respond?
The mutated tumors do not respond.
So basically, you're kind of cutting down the denominator of your benefit, so to speak.
Well,
you're kind of moving out that 40%.
But it's just like the microsatellite instability in irinotecan.
In a way, it's kind of like HER2.
Yeah, you're fashioning treatment according.
Right.
You go into the oncologic tailor. You're being fitted for a given treatment.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot about the issue that people, in terms of this whole concept of markers, they talk about trastuzumab and breast cancer and the fact that they've actually done modeling to show that if they'd done the original studies on all breast cancer patients, they would have been negative. But the fact that they were able to hone down on the 20 or 25% or eliminate, if the other way to look at it would be the non-responders, you know, they saw this benefit.
But the leukemia doctors have done this for years with cytogenetic prognostic groupings. Who gets a transplant? Who gets this? Who gets that?
Where do you think things are going in terms of analysis or prognosis or and predicting a response to therapy in the adjuvant setting? In breast cancer, we've seen really a complete change in the clinical management of node-negative ER-positive tumors, patients with node-negative ER-positive tumors based on the Oncotype. Now there's the MAMA print. And I know that there's similar efforts, like NSABP, for example, looking at this in colorectal cancer. Do you think that that's going to play out in the same manner over the next few years?
Well, I hope it will. I'm not convinced that it's quite there yet. We don't have the DNA patterns that were present. I mean, the basilar type breast cancer and linking that with the BRCA1 and all that. That isn't quite there yet in colon. On the other hand, if you take the number of deaths per year in colon cancer in the United States since 1990, it's dropped by 9% consistently. Some of that obviously is due to screening, but some of that is due to adjuvant therapy. If you take a look at control arms in, say, the Mosaic study, forgetting the oxaliplatin for the moment, but just take a look at stage 2 disease. It's 85-86%. This was not a highly selected group. This is stage 2 disease. This is very, very good. Maybe that's better surgery and better staging. If you take the stage...
That's still with 5-FU.
It is. If you take the stage 3 disease, it's around 70%. When I was growing up in this field, it was supposed to be 50%. Some of that, again, may be staging and technique, but the chemotherapy, the adjuvant chemotherapy, has made a major impact, and I think all to the better.
You mentioned this trial of metastatic disease, looking at cetuximab and bevacizumab, and I'm curious about where you think things might be heading in terms of basically the concept of double antibody therapy.
Well, it's controversial, in part because of the results of the PACE study, which are being presented again at this meeting. The PACE study was a randomized trial as first-line treatment where 4 out of 5 people got FOLFOX, the other got FOLFIRI, but they were then randomized to get bevacizumab, Avastin, either alone or in combination with panitumumab. And the justification for doing that was a randomized phase 2 trial that had been performed at Memorial that suggested that there was no detriment to this. Well, to everybody's surprise...
Of course, that was with cetuximab.
That was with cetuximab. You're right. In this circumstance, the PACE study has shown seeming detriment and increased toxicity. It remains unclear why that has occurred, but at least looking at the abstracts at this meeting compared to last spring, that difference appears to still be there. It's not enormous, but it certainly didn't improve things.
What's your take on this? I mean, the whole concept, I mean, I could see where maybe toxicity, you don't get as much therapy in, et cetera. But, I mean, could you envision some way where it actually would be counterproductive therapeutically in terms of anti-tumor benefit?
Oh, I suppose you could. I suppose...
I mean, what's your gut feeling about what's going on in this
study? We assume that bevacizumab works as an anti-angiogenesis drug. There are some who argue that it works maybe that way, and certainly does in renal cell cancer and islet cell tumors, but there are some who would argue that what it does is it increases the permeability of the cell membranes, so it's really modulating chemotherapy and making chemotherapy concentrations within the cell higher. Would that be interfering with the binding of a compound like cetuximab or panitumumab to the cell surface? Would it be changing conformation? I'm speculating. I don't know. As I understand it, none of the scientists from the companies that have brought us cetuximab or panitumumab at the moment have a solid answer either, and the final analysis isn't yet in on the PACE study.
I'd like to talk a little bit about clinical practice and management of patients in a non-protocol setting, starting out with metastatic disease. I'm curious, what are some of the things? I'm sure you see a lot of second and third opinions, so you're kind of getting a little bit of a perspective of what people are doing in practice. Are there any things that you see people doing in practice right now that maybe when you meet with your fellows, you kind of say, hey, you know, you got to really think maybe twice about this? Or, I'm not going to say errors, but things that you don't agree with.
Well, I don't think everybody with metastatic disease has to be treated. We've certainly learned in prostate cancer, just having prostate cancer doesn't mean you have to unleash everything. You have a Gleason 6 in a 65, 70, maybe 75-year-old. There's nothing wrong with waiting for a while. You have 3-4 asymptomatic nodules in the liver, which a surgeon says, gee, it isn't something I really want to operate on. The liver chemistry is normal and the CEA is reasonable. I see those people again in 3 months. I may scan them again in 6 months. months, I'm concerned about their quality of life because the cassette I'm putting into my management recorder here is my goal cure or is my goal palliation? If there are a couple lesions and the PET scan shows there are a couple lesions, then I'd go for cure. But not everybody has to be treated. Once you do start treatment, and particularly if you choose to use FOLFOX, then you find yourself in the issue of neurotoxicity. You find yourself in the issue of hypersensitivity. We have allergists now who are desensitizing patients to oxaliplatin so that they can continue to receive it. But you really can't get more than 8 or 9, 10 months into a patient, and their natural life expectancy is often 2, sometimes 3, and rarely even more than 3 years, even if you really can't cure them. So I guess it's stepping back and saying, how do I pace myself and how do I offer things in a judicious manner? The British have conducted a study which has argued that giving the treatment sequentially is as good as throwing everything in the refrigerator at them at once. And not everybody here has bought that initially. What I've been impressed with some savvy community oncologists, is that they've actually now, in people who they think don't need a very rapid response, very much want to be treated, and they think have a long life expectancy, they've chosen to use FOLFIRI simply because you can give it almost indefinitely. And you may give it, say, intensively for 3 or 4 or 5 months, but then you sort of spread it out. But you don't usually run into these toxicities where you have to stop. On the other hand, if you need a fast response, FOLFOX is very helpful.
Now, are you talking about FOLFIRI or FOLFIRI Bev?
Well, that's a good question. It can be FOLFIRI Bev. It can be FOLFIRI alone. I think it depends on the patient. It depends on how well they tolerate it, what their bowel function is. I've sometimes started people on FOLFIRI and then added Bev after 3, 4 months, if for no other reason than psychologically we're building, and it's my way of helping them cope with a very difficult problem so they feel that there's something being added to their regimen in a good way.
And, you know, understanding that these are selected patients, when you use your selection approach, what's sort of the longest you've been able to carry somebody without treatment?
A year, sometimes even a little longer. It was a funny situation, now that you bring this up. I saw a patient a couple of weeks ago who's actually a faculty member who had a perforated cancer with some peritoneal studding. And his wife's close friend is the widow of a patient of mine who had had 4 liver lesions, and I had watched him for more than a year. I wasn't happy watching the peritoneal carcinomatosis. I was happy watching an asymptomatic liver metastasis with normal liver chemistries. And the wives got together, and they couldn't understand why one was different. So it's, I guess, one size doesn't necessarily fit all, but it's just looking at the patient.
That's interesting. Why would you be more likely to treat peritoneal mets?
Because I'm always worried about them causing obstruction. I'm worried about them having other issues. I would be more likely in that patient to treat them early, and if they're doing well, stop for a while. Whereas with the liver disease, it's a much more objective way of following it with liver chemistries and a CEA. The first thing I'm going to find with a peritoneal carcinomatosis is when they have obstruction, and then I'm sort of up the creek. These aren't black and white rules. These are just things you do.
Well, another thing in that realm that there's a lot of sort of art oncology involved, and actually an area where right now when we do our patterns of care studies where we ask both investigators and GI cancer, and then just general oncologists in practice, this is one of the areas we see a big difference, which is sort of the concept of, quote, drug holidays. And what we see, actually, just only in the last year, I think because of the Optimox presentation last year, is a pretty strong tendency of the investigators to keep therapy going. So in a situation, for example, where we present a case of FOLFOX Bev, where the oxali gets stopped because of toxicity, the investigators are likely to keep Bev and 5-FU going, whereas in the community, you see more people stopping everything. How do you make that decision?
Talking with the patient. telling the patient that they're doing fine, that we have three options. One option is to keep our regular schedule. One option is to space out the schedule to once a month or every 6 weeks. And another option is let's rescan you in 3 months. And what makes them comfortable? Sometimes they go home and think about it. If they can't make a decision and they're really perfectly well, I'm happy to go with the drug holiday or spacing them out. But I don't usually keep treating them every 2 weeks simply because I like to see them get involved in something else than coming to visit me.
What were your thoughts about the Optimox 2 study that suggested if you stop everything, you don't do as well?
It isn't that they don't do as well. They have a slightly shorter prognosis. But stepping back, you know, to 40,000 feet, our goal is palliative care here. Our goal is maintaining their quality of life and keeping them alive and functional as long as possible. For some patients, you can't stop. You shouldn't stop. For other patients, they need that stop. They want to take a cruise. They want to spend time sailing. They want to, whatever they want to do. I don't think it's black and white. I think the black and white issues come in adjuvant therapy because here the goal is cure. If the goal is cure, I'm going to hold them really to it. But if the goal is really keeping them functional and well, I think some flexibility is useful. My own bias is those large randomized trials don't take that into account. I suppose when you compare what a GI oncologist and a community oncologist would say, sometimes it's helpful also to ask what the patient would say and what the patient's wishes would be, assuming there isn't a major difference in outcome. So I like to make them part of the decision tree.
What about as you move farther down the line and patients get third, fourth line therapy, sort of following this theme of the art of oncology and talking to patients, can you talk a little bit about how you approach the timing of or bringing up the issue of withholding or not using active anti-tumor therapy and transitioning into hospice?
Really depends how symptomatic they are. If they're not symptomatic and they want it, I continue to give them some sort of fluoropyrimidine-based therapy. Could be capecitabine, Xeloda, could be 5-FU leucovorin, could be the 48-hour infusion of the FOLFIRI or the FOLFOX because they're used to it without those drugs. Really depends on the patient. And as they become symptomatic and I'm moving more towards opioids or pain medicines or the Ritalins or all the other things, start talking about getting some help in the home and the VNA and then a bridge to hospice and then eventually to hospice. I think time is a wonderful tool because colon cancer is not a disease where the battle is won or lost within a week or a month. It's not pancreatic cancer. Patients with advanced disease whose biology is somewhat indolent can live for a good period of time. And so it's a partnership, I think, between me, my nurses, the patient, their family, into guiding them in the easiest possible way. So it's hard to be really dogmatic.
Anything you want to add to anything you said today?
Yeah, I could think of something else. How do we follow patients? How often should they get CT scans? Why do we do a lot of CT scans? And I'm personally fascinated to watch from the sidelines how guidelines have changed somewhat. And I'm curious to see how the recent provocative argument that all those CT scans are exposing people to a lot of radiation, which appeared in the New England Journal recently, whether that will influence it. There have been, I think, 3 randomized trials that have tried to determine whether intensive, expensive, time-consuming interventions as follow-up alter survival. And the only thing that fell out of that was colonoscopy, and the colonoscopy was really looking for polyps and new cancers.
So you have a patient with stage 3 disease. What do you usually do for follow-up?
Well, I hadn't done CT scans. What I had done in the past was a colonoscopy after their adjuvant therapy. and followed them with CEAs on a quarterly basis and liver chemistry semi-annually for 5 years. 90-95% of the recurrences are going to happen within 5 years. And then guidelines changed about 3-4 years ago, based really on sort of a retrospective British experience that was published, and I think some concern that people had that CEA wasn't the ideal or adequate or a totally accurate test, and the notion that for somebody with an occult node or liver nodule could resect it and there'd be a cure. So the guidelines now are to do a CT scan annually for 3 years. Within our own group, we have a difference of opinion. Some people don't want to do it at all. Some people want to do it every 6 months.
I've heard people talk about every 3 months.
Hey, why not do it once a week?
Well, actually, I had Nick Petrelli in here earlier today, and he chaired one of these, you know, groups looking at this issue. And, of course, his thing and their thing was exactly what you say, trying to find the patient who might be surgically resectable. How does that grab you in terms of the rationale?
Well, it's a small numerator and a very large denominator. If you're the numerator, you're very grateful. If you're the denominator and you're the health policy guru, and now you're going to say, how much radiation are all those CT scans going to give someone? And who's going to pay for all of those things? I don't know. I don't have a form dogmatic feeling. I'm just interested to watch how this has changed. On the one hand, in the early 2000 or so, ASCO and NCCN argued sort of against doing anything because there weren't data. Then in 2004, it changed. I think Rich Goldberg wrote the editorial on that in the JCO, and he sort of equivocated too and finally said, gee, I suppose if it were me, I guess I'd have it, so maybe it's okay. But he was sort of waffling, and now we're at the other side where there's a question of could it possibly cause more harm. And I think I guess a little bit bothered by the fact that we are a clinical trial driven profession, subspecialty, and the prospective clinical trials haven't shown that it has helped a large number of people. Of course, for the one person, the anecdotal person that it helps, that's the one you remember. So how this will play out over the next few years, whether we'll be doing MRs that don't have radiation risk if there are more MR machines, I guess it's stay tuned and let's see what happens.
I got to ask you one more practical clinical question that popped into my head when I mentioned the issue of surgically resectable liver mets. What's your approach to those patients in terms of the controversy of whether to use preoperative systemic therapy?
I generally give 3 cycles of chemotherapy before surgery for 2 reasons. One, I want to be sure in 3 months that a patient isn't sprouting disease in an extrahepatic site and it would be a needless operation. So I get a PET, then I treat him 3 months, 6 cycles, get another PET, and if there's nothing more, that's fine. And the second reason is it's a bioassay to see if there's sensitivity, because if it is sensitive, then after they have the surgery, I'm going to give them more chemotherapy of that type. And if it's not sensitive, it really hasn't changed, I'm certainly not going to continue that same type of treatment. There is concern that if you give too much chemotherapy, you're going to get liver damage. So to my judgment, you don't want to give too much. You don't want to give quite too little. But I generally don't take the person directly to the surgeon in the operating room.